Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome from London to this panel on the geopolitics of Greece, continuities and discontinuities, organized by the Hellenic Observatory of the London School of Economics. My name is Spyros Economides, and I'll be chairing today's panel, which is part of a series called the 21 in 21 Initiative. This is an initiative celebrating the 2021 bicentenary of the outbreak of the Greek War of Independence. And it takes its shape around 21 Greek-British encounters, representing a wide range of activities meant to reflect collaboration across a variety of London-based and UK-based institutions and organizations in an attempt to engage a broader audience of specialists as well as non-specialists into this bicentenary. This, in effect, is the last event that the Hellenic Observatory is organizing as part of this initiative. And it's a great pleasure to introduce our three panelists today, who are going to speak on the question of geopolitics and to what extent this is a valid explanation of Greek foreign policy and provides a bridge between 1821 and 2021 in terms of placing Greece in Europe and the broader international order. And our panelist today is indeed a very special one. First to speak will be Dr. Konstantina Botsiou, who has studied history and archaeology at the University of Athens and holds a PhD from the University of Tübingen. She is an associate professor and director of the Center for Greek and International History at the Department of Political Science and International Relations of the University of the Peloponnese. Our second panelist and speaker today is Professor Eric Goldstein. Eric is professor of international relations and history at Boston University. And before that, when he was in Europe, he was professor of international history in the Center for Byzantine, Ottoman, and Modern Greek Studies at the University of Birmingham. And last but not least, our last speaker is Professor George Prevelakis, who is emeritus professor at Sorbonne University and permanent representative of Greece at the OECD. And he is a specialist on geopolitics, and he's published extensively in that particular field. Now, for those of you who feel the need to tweet during this panel, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSCGreece. Let me remind you that this event is being recorded and will be made available as a video and a podcast once the event is finished. And at the end of our panelists' presentations, there will be, of course, an opportunity for our audience to put questions. Please use the question and answer feature at the bottom of the screen, and I will gather the questions and put them to our speakers, depending on to whom they're addressed and what the subject of the questions are. Those of you who are watching the event live on Facebook, please add your questions and comments. So it's a great pleasure for me to introduce all of our speakers, and let me turn now to Konstantina Botsiou, who's going to kick off by making her short presentation on her version of events at the geopolitics of Greece 1821-2021. Konstantina, over to you.
Thank you very much, Spyros. Thank you very much for inviting me to this very important conference with wonderful panelists, colleagues, and it takes place on the day of our national holiday here in Greece. We commemorate the 1940 Axis invasion to Greece, so Chronia Pola to the Greeks that listen to us. And I'll immediately start with a topic. I would like to point out five continuities and five discontinuities in Greek geopolitics since the 1821 revolution. Starting with the continuities. The first concerns the naval character of the Greek state. That was not made by accident, but it was a fundamental objective of the Greek revolutionaries, who not only exploited British-Russian antagonism, as we well know, but mainly sided with the naval powers Britain and post-Napoleonic France. So the Greeks sought to become their indispensable naval partners in the region. How did this happen? In the late 18th century, the Greeks were dominating maritime Ottoman trade through flourishing communities in the entire Mediterranean, from Smyrna to Marseilles and from Odessa to Alexandria. There were two windows of opportunity that permitted them to develop a large modern merchant fleet. First, the privilege to fly the Russian flag, transporting, among others, precious Russian wheat under the Treaty of Kutukai-Narja, 1774, and second, the break of naval blockades during the Napoleonic Wars, in which the Greeks emerged as a promising maritime partner. The lesson was not lost, especially to the British, who realized that the Ottoman Empire was not sustainable in the long term, whereas nationalism and liberalism would outlive Napoleon's downfall. So the Greeks were viewed as the natural heirs to the Ottoman Empire in the Southern Balkans and as a bulwark against Russia for the future. Now, during the revolution, the pillars of British influence among the Greeks were islanders and politicians who envisaged a naval center of gravity for the future state. After the revolution, the great idea, the Redentist program of the Greeks, prioritized maritime areas again, like Crete, the Ionian Islands. They entered the state in 1864, the North Aegean Islands, 1920, the Dodecanese Islands, 1947, or continental shields of the seas like Macedonia and Thrace. Naval might rendered the Greeks invaluable allies in the Balkan Wars and, of course, in both world wars. So Greece's current position as a major security provider of the West in the Eastern Mediterranean is deeply rooted in that strategy. Greek shipping is the largest in the world, and the Hellenic Navy a pivotal player in East Mediterranean conflicts. The so-called triangular relations built around Cyprus with Egypt and Israel, as well as the recent French-Greek defense agreement, underscore that impressively long-lasting geopolitical legacy. A subsequent geopolitical continuity is the almost unquestionable alignment of Greece with the dominant naval force in the Eastern Mediterranean. For over one century, that was Britain. Since the Cold War, it has been the United States. There were two major challenges to that alignment. First, the national schism of 1915 between Anglophiles around Venizelos and Germanophiles around King Constantine I. And second, the Greek Civil War of the 1940s. Otherwise, Greek elites deemed the alliance with Britain or the United States later on beneficial for their geopolitical interests. Regarding the great idea and Greek-British relations, there were disagreements concerning particularly the pace of Greek territorial expansion. Greeks, a small nation, preferred quick action in the face of changeable great power relations and Balkan antagonisms. Britain, as a great power itself, invested on a long-term dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, insisting nevertheless that Greece should expand gradually to the sea. A deep rift opened between Athens and London for the first time with the Cyprus issue in the 1950s. It also affected the psychological orientation of the Greeks to the West altogether, not only regarding Greek-British relations, but also Greek-American and Greek-NATO relations. From that time on, and until very recently, we believe, the long-term political pro-Westernism coexisted with the centuries-old psychological ambivalence of the Greeks towards the West, sometimes has been also called anti-Westernism. A third geopolitical continuity is entailed in the strong symbolism of Greece's profile as a root of Western civilization, and that's not just ideologically important, but also geopolitically. This unique profile authenticates Greece's role as a frontline state of the West. It also enables Greece and Cyprus to operate as bridges of the West towards the Eastern Mediterranean, the Near East, as we used to call it, or even the Middle East. And this has been a distinct Greek strategy over the years. The modern identity of the Greek nation is actually an uncommon amalgam of Orthodox, religious, and classical, secular, Greek tradition that can relate either or both to religious and secular identities. And this has been very, very important for the West in the region of the Near East. This amalgam was set up in the revolution. Until the 18th century, the Greeks identified themselves mainly with the Orthodox millet and the Orthodox great power in the area, namely Russia. They actually expected Russia to liberate the Greeks from the Ottomans. But the Enlightenment and the French Revolution, but also the American Revolution, ended that ideological monopoly and proved game changers. So after the restoration of the Ancien Régime, Britain became the champion of the modern political idea of Greece, filling the vacuum of France. Philhellenism had an iconic leader, Lord Byron, who was British, of course, and was a prominent example of that new role of the British towards Greekness. The classical ideal became the modern secular equivalent to the Greeks' pre-modern religious identity within the Orthodox millet. The idea of Greekness precipitated the alienation from the rest Orthodox Balkan peoples during the 19th century, but also from Russia itself. Again, geopolitics went hand in hand with the ideology. Alienation became presumably irreversible after the Crimean War, when Russia embraced Pan-Slavism, supporting the competitive South Slavic nationalisms. Greece's dual identity reserves her until today a special place in Western and regional organization, as well as in her bridge-building policy in the region. The fourth geopolitical continuity concerns Balkan geopolitics, which is a greater part of an extension of Greek geopolitics. The establishment of the Greek state inaugurated the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire in the direction envisaged by the British. Modern Greece and later modern Turkey became the pillars of Western geopolitics in the region, whereas the rest Balkan states developed beyond the straits. That horizontal allocation deviated sharply from the vertical allocation anticipated by the Russian and the Austrian empires in the Eastern question. But what was crucial was that the British transformed the Eastern question into a Mediterranean issue, in which also France had a say. Actually, France became the junior partner of Britain after 1830, after the July Revolution. The three admirals in the Sea Battle of Navarino, which was catalytic for the Greek Revolution, provide a picture of that new geopolitical approach. That approach offered two advantages. First, the Mediterranean issues lay typically outside the Russian sphere of influence, outside the Eastern question. And second, the British and the French could erode the Ottoman Empire at sea without affecting the British status quo doctrine in continental Europe. Not only the Greek Revolution, but also in other crises of the 19th century, we've seen the subtle distinction applied to further issues. For instance, the two Ottoman-Egyptian wars of the 1830s and 1840s. And this point brings me to the fifth and last geopolitical continuum I'd like to mention, namely the Turkish challenge for Greece. The internal balance in that horizontal allocation between Greece and Turkey was determined by consecutive wars between the two nations, culminating in the Asia Minor campaign 100 years ago. The Treaty of Lausanne of 1923 became the cornerstone of Greek-Turkish friendship, actually, between 1930 and 1950. But again, the eruption of the Cyprus issue ended the honeymoon, bringing the two countries repeatedly since then to the brink of war. They have returned to a state of blatant hostility, which is uniquely awkward, as they're inextricably connected in NATO's southeastern flank. This continuity of antagonism between the two nations plays a major role in the defense strategies, not only of both countries, but also of NATO itself. Now, let me turn briefly to discontinuities, which can be further analyzed in the Q&A session, as they're more recent and hardly change these geopolitical continuities that I've tried to present. The first discontinuity has to do with the rapprochement with the Balkan neighbors after the end of the Cold War. That's new and breaks a continuity that existed since the Greek Revolution, a continuity of hostility between the nations in the region, except perhaps for the good relations between Greeks and Serbs, but it was totally different with Bulgarians and Albanians. And in this, apart from the economic component of Greece's opening up to the Balkans since 1990, the settlement of the North Macedonian issue underlines a radical change. A second discontinuity has to do with the close cooperation between Greece and Israel in the region, which cross-cuts the traditional Greek bridge-building policy towards the Arabs. but has permitted an unprecedented and effective regional alliance between the Greeks and the Israelis, but also other countries next to them. A third discontinuity has to do with the departure of Greek foreign policy in very recent years from the Turkocentric line. This is discernible in the expanding relations with countries of the far abroad, such as South Korea, India, the United Arab Emirates, Azerbaijan, China, and others. And it seems like a revival of a cosmopolitanism after the gradual disappearance of the Greek diaspora communities in the 19th and 20th century. A fourth discontinuity is one I have also mentioned and has to do with the deterioration of Greek-British relations after the Cyprus issue. Although things have changed in the past years, and still, despite that rift, Greek-British relations remain very close in many important areas such as defense, trade, shipping, education, war memory, since we talked about the anniversary today, and many other areas. A final point of discontinuity concerns the geopolitical elevation of a small state like Greece through participation in the post-war system of international organizations. This participation constitutes a major strategy of Greece, and it has enabled modern Greece to concentrate for the first time in their history on economic development. In a way, NATO membership has enabled EU membership as a strategy of prosperity and modernization. And this is perhaps the most radical departure, the most radical discontinuity from the revolution of 1821, the departure from poverty and insecurity. Thank you very much.
Konstantina, thank you very much. You've raised a number of very important and interesting issues there, ranging from obviously the maritime naval traditions, relations with other neighbors, and of course, Greece's position in Europe and other international organizations, which I think are going to come up again and again in our discussion. Let me move on now to Professor Eric Goldstein and welcome him to make his remarks. Eric, over to you.
All right, thank you very much. And I'm going to be picking up indeed some of the themes that we just heard about. And since we're focusing on geopolitics, again, to just observe that Greece is not only a country with a lot of history, but an abundance of geographical identities. It's often been its advantage and sometimes its burden. It's been described as European, Mediterranean, Near Eastern, lots of labels, but no matter how you label it, Greece has always been at the vortex. And this means at one time or another, all the great powers have turned up there with an interest and involvement in what's happening in Greece. So again, recalling 1821 now in 2021, I think it's often, when I speak to audiences here, useful to mention it is the first successful national revolt in Europe, or indeed anywhere. And suddenly it's when Europe remembers that Greece is part of Europe. Greece was in the end able to leverage this into support for the cause of independence, but it took a bit of time. It was, after all, a decades-long struggle to achieve independence. When it began 200 years ago, Greece was on the periphery of what the European powers considered to be Europe. The Ottoman Empire and the lands controlled by it weren't seen by the Europeans as Europe. After all, Europe is as much an idea as pure geography, something that's sort of debated still today. But the events of the Greek revolt caught the attention of the European powers, though initially there was little enthusiasm on the parts of the governments, it was more on the parts of people. And the great powers, by the way, always hate instability, they hate disruption, they prefer what they know. But the endurance of the Greek cause gave it the longevity to bring in the great powers. And as was mentioned, one of the big events, the catalytic event in some ways, was the Battle of Navarino, 1827, which, by the way, is a conceptual innovation in international relations, which Greece has helped do more than once. As far as I can tell, it's the first ever multinational military intervention for humanitarian reasons. There was no big strategic reason involved. And we'll see more innovations that came about because of great power involvement in this region. But let me just go to another event, just to go through this 200-year period we're looking at. There was another big geopolitical development. 1869, the Suez Canal opens. And it revolutionized the geography of world power. And suddenly, the Eastern Mediterranean is of far greater interest to the great powers. And they're each wary of each other. They're each suspicious of each other. And increasingly, much of the world's commerce is being channeled through the Eastern Mediterranean. It's no longer a cul-de-sac. It's now the major thoroughfare of a world, most of whose commerce is seaborne. Greece, therefore, becomes, after this, even more strategically important, which leads to another interesting series of events. We're looking at 1821 and the creation of the modern Greek state at its core, but it's, of course, not all of what Greece will ultimately be, as was mentioned. Crete was a major event. In 1897-98, Crete, which was still under Ottoman rule, revolted, something the Cretans were doing fairly frequently. But this time, it achieved international engagement because of its geographical location on the maritime center of the Eastern Med. And the great powers, trying to keep an eye on each other, were worried Crete's within striking distance of the key sea lanes. So they're not quite willing to allow a Gnosis union with Greece, which the population wanted. On the other hand, they accept that it can't remain any longer under effectively Ottoman rule. And they have another innovation. They invent the idea of the High Commissioner of the Powers. A representative of the international community will govern Greece. Admittedly, it was a Greek prince, George. But this idea of the High Commissioner representing the great powers in the region to represent a wider global interest, we see later in Bosnia and Kosovo. It's the beginning of this. It's another innovation. So also to continue just thinking about how the geographies involved Greece with the great powers, the Cold War, which we were also just hearing about. The Greek Civil War was in some ways the first early important event of the Cold War. And I won't go into here the significance for the internal history of Greece. But when we look at what was happening there, part of that was, as the war was ending, Winston Churchill, the British Prime Minister, negotiating with Joseph Stalin, the Soviet leader, in the percentages agreement, was desperate to retain control of Greece for the British interests in the region and the West, and was willing, in fact, to acknowledge, sacrifice the rest of the Balkans to Soviet control by accepting it. And this is a deal that they made there. Though when Britain became overstretched, it managed to outsource the role to the United States, which becomes engaged in the region. The Truman Doctrine, 1947, when you do American foreign policy history, is a seismic event. And it's about US engagement with Greece, really, and the Civil War. It changes the US from having a traditional doctrine of only hemispheric engagement in the Western Hemisphere to one of global involvement. And that's going to be part of an evolving story of the Cold War. So Greece is in many ways the pivot of American involvement that brings America militarily into the Eastern Mediterranean rather than running schools and hospitals. And that continues into how to bring Greece into the new security architecture that's developing when what I think has to be one of the biggest geographical leaps of the imagination. In 1952, Greece becomes a member of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Now, Greece has many geographical identities, but it's clearly not in the North Atlantic. But by international agreement of many major powers, it now is, and it will remain so for the rest of the Cold War. These all affect Greece's notional geographical identity. People in Greece might still talk about going to Europe, but it's now in Western Europe as far as international relations work. And that's followed by membership of the EU in 1981, still the Cold War era, which reaffirms that Greece is a Western European state. But then we get the end of the Cold War and the end of this idea of an Eastern and Western Europe. And the geopolitics and the identity are going to shift yet again, because the artificial dividing lines of the Cold War are now gone. And the basic geographical importance of Greece remains. It's still where it's always been. And we see this now in what's actually fairly early on from a historical viewpoint of a post-Cold War era, that the, for example, latest aspirant great power has now turned up. The People's Republic of China, with the Belt and Road Initiative, showing a significant interest in Greece's maritime identity, which was just pointed out. So I think, as always, the challenge for Athens is to both deal with the challenges indeed of such interest, and it has to work out how to deal with great powers turning up with their interest, and often how best to leverage it for its advantage, something that goes right back to the legacy of 1821. I'll stop there and turn over to the next person.
Eric, thank you very much. And I think you put a very interesting spin on this by concentrating both on the great powers and their attraction to Greece and its sort of geopolitical milieu. But I am particularly interested in Navarino as humanitarian intervention and the High Commissioner of the Great Powers, which is a sort of forerunner of the Troika of the 1990s, visiting itself on Bosnia, Kosovo, and elsewhere. So I'm sure these are things we'd return to later on. Thank you very much indeed. Now over to George Brevelakis.
Many thanks for this invitation and this extremely interesting discussion, debate. My field, my approach is geography, geopolitics, if you like. And from the point of view of geopolitics, Greece is an extraordinary case. If we want to study geopolitics, it is very useful to see things through the Greek viewpoint. In fact, as Eric has said, many important events, many innovations focus on Greece. And that, however, should not lead to a kind of a proud approach from the Greeks, because, of course, it's not the Greeks themselves that provoked all those events and innovations, but rather it is what I would call the Greek theme that has been in the center of very often of certainly European, Mediterranean, sometimes global geopolitics. Now, in geopolitics, we are very much interested in combining two scales, two geographical scales, the internal and the external. In fact, we are a bit inspired by medicine, where the medical profession in the 19th century thought that you have to see the combination between the internal and the external environment. The external environment of Greece, I believe, has one continuity and one discontinuity. All this is quite relative. The continuity is what a colleague of mine has called the philosophical rent. The fact that the Greek theme has attracted an enormous attention from the West, for reasons that finally had nothing to do with Greece or with the Greeks. It had to do with the construction of the European identity. In the 18th century, Europe is changing radically through the Enlightenment, through the French Revolution, the American Revolution. And the elites that are driving this change have to find a utopia, a myth. And this myth was ancient Greece, ancient Rome as well. So it was essential to focus on this heritage, of course, from different viewpoints according to each nation. For the Greek history, the German case is the most interesting. As a very well-known specialist in German history here in France, Michel Espagne said at a certain moment, the Germans, in order to become Germans, had first to become Greeks. So in fact, Greece had to be invented, even if it didn't exist, it should be invented. And this explains why there is so much investment by Europe, by the Europeans, for the creation of Greece. First of all, during after the independence, and then especially when obviously the local forces were unable to not only to construct, but even to conceive a modern state. And therefore, we have the presence of the Germans, of the Bavarians, who, after having constructed a lot of neoclassical buildings, were in the process of creating a neoclassical state. But of course, reality and imagination do not coincide, and we get into all those sometimes amusing incidents of this interplay. Now, so we have this rent. I mean, Greece obtains a lot of things because of this function inside the construction of the European identity. And this is something that continues up until today. We continue to obtain a lot of benefits, like, for example, getting into the European Union, for which there is the famous phrase of Giscard d'Estaing, we cannot let Socrates wait on the door. The element of discontinuity, which links us to the maritime question, is what Eric mentioned. I mean, because at the moment of the creation of the Greek state, the strategic interest was limited. But of course, with Suez, things changed a lot. And therefore, a second source of rent has been added, which is the strategic rent. So Greece managed to go through two centuries benefiting from rent. And this is good on the other side, but very bad from the other side, because living out of rent becomes an illness that makes you not to mobilize your forces as you could and as you should. Now, the maritime question, which is very important, has been mentioned by both my predecessors. We have to see how it links with this philosophical rent, because the Germans, when they thought about Greece, of course, together with the other Europeans, they had a certain image of Greece, which did not correspond with the Greek space. The Greek space was a diaspora, and it was a diaspora with the main focus, which is center in the sea, not in the land. It was an archipelago, essentially. This did not correspond with their own experience of geography, and it did not correspond with their imagination about ancient Greece, in which there were two main points, Athens and Sparta. If you draw an ellipse around those two points, you get the first Greek territory, which was not the result, if you like, of a kind of a liberation, but rather a construction. And this kind of territory started a process of alienating the Greek nation from the sea. Of course, it was not possible. Of course, there have been a lot of other elements and other factors that resisted, but we do see as a geopolitical or geographical continuity in the modern Greek history, this kind of struggle between a maritime, which is expressed through the diaspora, through the merchant marine, etc., and a more territorial approach, which has to do with the mountainous populations of what is Greece, but also with a certain perception, imagination, vision from the Europe. So I think that many things in the history and the society and the economy of Greece can be explained through this dialectic between inside geography or inside geopolitics and outside geopolitics. Thank you.
George, thank you very much indeed for giving us a different viewpoint on the nature and importance of geopolitics to looking at Greece and continuities and discontinuities. While I wait for some of the members of the audience to put their questions through the Q&A, could I just kick off by asking a couple of questions of my own, which hopefully all the members of the panel will have an attempt at discussing and answering. The first thing I'd like to ask is slightly more conceptual, if you want, a bit more abstract, and deals with the idea of geopolitics itself as a concept, which is used both by geographers, but also by international relations scholars and international historians. And I just wonder whether you have a view as to whether this notion of geopolitics has changed since 1821, and whether we can compare the geopolitics of that era with the geopolitics of today conceptually. Is it a static concept? Or is it one which evolves over time and is somehow imbued by what we want to imbue it with? So that's my first question. And my second related question is, if that is the case, is it the great powers that define geopolitics? And this is something that Eric was alluding to, I think, in his remarks. And I just wondered, because if we go through the various historical ages that all of you have been talking about, it seems to me that it's always the great powers in one form or another that have been defining the geopolitics of Greece, or if you want, the geopolitics of the region of the Eastern Mediterranean. And I wonder to what extent you may want to comment on that. Konstantina, can I turn to you and ask you which of these questions, or both, if you'd like to answer, the concept of geopolitics changing and whether it's great powers really that make geopolitics?
Yes, thank you, Spiros. I tend to agree with you that great powers define geopolitics, and as long as great powers remain more or less the same, even with differing names perhaps, and different empires, so to say, or spheres of influence in the past and now, let's say, areas where they are quite powerful, this is very important. For instance, we see that the entire Near East, Middle East has changed after colonialism in the decolonization era. But still, Britain is there, Russia is there, France is a very important player. The US has come up, as has emerged as a new partner, of course, but again, as a major naval power. Not going into the traditional, let's say, military differentiation between land powers and naval powers, although it's very important to see that too, but the geopolitics in our region have remained to a great extent similar to that of the 19th century when the Greek Revolution erupted. And what is important about smaller players like Greece is that they have tried to co-shape them, or at least to adapt to the changes that happened around them. As long as Greece adapted, everything went well in its foreign policy. When disharmonization existed, that was usually detrimental for her national interests as well. So the great powers are very important, I would say, as a final answer, but also the smaller countries can really pressure the great powers to a certain orientation, to a certain direction, and have their own way into that new map of geopolitics that is being created.
Okay, thank you. Eric, great powers, static idea of geopolitics, which of those are you willing to have a go at?
I'll have a go at a bit of both of them. I think, first of all, how the geopolitics works is also the changing world of technology. And also where the great power is located. I'm going to start with the great power view. Now, if you were sort of Germany at one point, you were very land-centric. Britain was a maritime empire. Britain isn't interested in any part of the world it can't get to by ship. And therefore there are these remote areas to it. And so therefore it's thinking about the sea routes through. This is how Britain turns up in the region. And so it's that framing of things. In fact, air developments, the development of airplanes changes the map again. And in fact, one reason Crete became important was it was seen as a stopping point on a route between Britain and the rest of its empire by air. So again, the world changes with technology, and it keeps changing as well today. And it's interesting to watch China defining its global map as it tries to work out what a Belt and Road Initiative is, which, as far as I can work out, maybe they should read the story of the Baghdad Railway the other way around, because there was an earlier effort to do this. The reason the great powers are important in defining geography is because they have the ability to project power and intervene. And so therefore it's important to think how the great powers think about global geography, and the mental maps of the decision makers in the great powers are very important. If you sit in Moscow, you see the world very differently than if you sit in Washington. When the first UN conference was held, they decided on what the flag would look like. We all know the UN flag. They asked a local American flag maker to make the flag, and it turned out that it had the United States in the center of the map. And the other participants had to turn the map of the world so that it was actually where the projection you see today. Everybody sees themselves in the center. And one of the tasks, I think, of diplomacy is to raise the awareness. And this is where small and middle-sized states do have effective diplomacy, is they can affect also how people see the geopolitics of the world. And that's an important aspect. That's one reason organizations like the UN and equivalent bodies are so important, because that also helps give voice to that.
George, would you like to perhaps start with the question of, you know, the changing or unchanging nature of geopolitics from a conceptual point of view, and then perhaps say a few things about great powers, if you so wish.
The issue of geopolitics has come back after decades, and I think it's useful to remind that there was the what is called the German geopolitical school, the school of Haushofer. Geopolitics were very fashionable between the two wars, and that for a very precise reason, that geographers played a very important role in drawing the map of Europe after the First World War. And people realized that maps and geography play a role. But of course, geography has been used. It has been used by the Germans. They had a vision which was very simplistic from the point of view of theory. And afterwards, it was completely abandoned. It's coming back. But of course, this comeback means that sometimes the memory, the history of the discipline is not there. And the effort to realize the theoretical complexity of geopolitics is not there. So, of course, great powers are important, but what defines the behavior and the capacity of great powers? So we have to get also into the internal geopolitics of the great powers and not the relationship between them. And then the other issue that we have to take into consideration, Eric mentioned it. He spoke about mental maps. My professor, who was French but finished his career in Oxford, Jean Gottman, used to say that the most rigid borders are in the minds of people. And this introduces this very important element in geopolitics, contrary to the perception, which is that the spiritual dimension, the cultural dimension, is very important. We can see that, of course, in a very clear way in the debate about identities. And we see that identities are not fixed. They move, but they move according to certain rules. So what I want to say is that we get into a debate in the field that has great complexity, and that needs really a very careful analysis in order to avoid oversimplifications. This is something that is happening nowadays because geopolitics are fashionable, and because there are journalists that have found out that it may be an easy way to explain things to people, but it can also lead to misinterpretations.
Thank you very much. It reminds me a bit of the Winston Churchill speech on the Iron Curtain, which indeed he said was an iron curtain of the mind.
Of course.
Which I think is something that has to be remembered, that it's not simply a physical disconnect between East and Western Europe with this barrier in the middle, but it's a curtain which separates ways of thinking, both spiritual, cultural, and ideological. Let me move on to a slightly different question, which is related again to what we've been talking about. I'll ask this question, then I'll move to the questions that are being put by members of the audience as well. Of course, the tradition of geopolitics conceptually, as you said, has its home in a variety of different places. But from my point of view, of course, one of the most important people writing about geopolitics was, in fact, a director of the London School of Economics, Harold Mackinder. And one of the other preeminent, if you want, practitioners of geopolitics was an American, Admiral Mahan. So in this respect, coming back to my question, is the idea of geopolitics one which is in the purview of the great powers? Let me put it to you in a slightly different way. We discussed this, but isn't every state, every country, every nation at a crossroads? So, you know, every single actor that we wish to focus on has its own geopolitical sphere and identity, which can be filled with all sorts of positives and negatives, which can result in all sorts of complications in terms of international relations. Is there anything really special about Greece in this sense? Are we simply using a concept to discuss Greece, or is there something special about Greece in the context of geopolitics? Eric, can I start with you on this occasion? Would you like to try and address that question?
Yes, and I'll just observe as an aside, since I taught for a little while at a place established by Admiral Mahan, the first thing I was handed when I arrived was a copy of The Influence of Sea Power Upon History. And so the ghost of Mahan is still there in current military thinking. So, yes, I do think there is something special about Greece in this. But George was also pointing out some of these legacies. So unlike other countries around the world, you see images of Greece everywhere in the architecture and aspects. When people talk about democracy, they'll reference back. There is a legacy there that's different than other countries. And it's visual as well as conceptual around the world. And that does make it a bit different. But in terms of Greece, as opposed to the Greek legacy, the geography is what the geography has always been. It is where it is. And that involves a lot of great powers in thinking about it. And Mackinder, who had sort of various keys to the world that needed to be controlled, which the British busily tried to get control of. Greece is strategically located around several of those aspirational aspects. So yes, I think any great power with this intellectual legacy, it's going to be there, but it also is, I think, just geographical reality. How often though, political leaders are versed in geography, which might be a separate topic, is one worth considering, because sometimes the grasp isn't as strong as one would hope it to be.
Would you care to give us an example?
I was just saying. I can think of various examples of decisions made on maps of too small a scale, but I will give one from 1919, so almost 100 years between our events today. At one stage in the Paris Peace Conference, the great prime ministers and leaders of the Western powers, Woodrow Wilson from the United States, Lloyd George for Britain, Georges Clemenceau for France, were on their hands and knees in a conference room trying to decide how to divide up Anatolia. And they had the map in front of them rolled out on the floor until one of the aides gently coughed and pointed out they were actually looking at a map of Silesia in Central Europe. And hadn't actually realized for several minutes that was the case. So even at the highest levels, it's useful to have geographical knowledge amongst the aides, if not amongst the leaders.
George, would you like to comment on the point about...
The temptation to go back to our ancestors is very big. Let me remind you that the greatest American specialist of geopolitics was Isaiah Bowman, who used to be the president of Johns Hopkins University. In fact, when I had the fellowship there, I used to see his statue every day. Bowman was the leader of a team of cartographers and geographers that went together with the American president to Paris to furnish the maps. And as he said, he did not distort reality, but rather he selected the maps. When the map he produced was favorable to the American interests, he would show it. If it was not, he would simply hide it. This is the beginning of the conflict around geopolitics during this period. So it's I think that great leaders had an understanding of geography. But of course, this has to do also with the educational tradition of the past, where they really had a view of history and geography which was deep, and that was extremely useful. Now it is true that now it is becoming less and less present, and we tend to think that technology can solve those problems without going through the difficult road of knowing and understanding the history and geography. And we have seen a lot of disasters, not only about history and geography, but also about cultures, about people, about the knowledge. We know that services that have the responsibility for the security of states underestimated this, and they are returning now, and there is a demand for students that have studied history, languages, and geography. So it is great powers, certainly, but when we say great powers or small powers, we have to see what there is behind. In fact, if I can add just one thing which I think is important about the relevance of geography and geopolitics today, what we are living today is a backlash from globalization. And this is absolutely the vision of geopolitics, because we are interested in two concepts. The one concept is the movement, circulation, and we have seen an explosion of circulation during the last decades. But then what we discuss in geography is that circulation destabilizes, and therefore in front of instability, we have the emergence of what Gottman called iconographies, that is the self-defense of communities in order to limit circulation. And this can take the form of nationalism, of religious ideologies, and leads to a tendency to close the world again. This is exactly what we are seeing today.
Okay, thank you, George. There's a number of things I'd like to ask all of you that have come up as a result of the first two answers, and please feel free to comment on each other's answers as well. Konstantina, do you want to add anything at this point to the discussion?
Yes, thank you, Spiros. Spike Mama-Kinder debate is eternal, as you know, since geography remains the same, but geopolitics is something different. It's how you use politics to make your geography look better for you. So geopolitically, all nations are important. What makes Greece perhaps special, not this special, but a special case, is that Greece geographically is very interesting, as it lies between two straits, the Dardanelles and the Suez Canal now. It's a southern European country, it's a Balkan country as well. But also geopolitically, apart from geography, Greece has aligned itself usually with the power that can impose peace, that is militarily powerful enough to impose peace. And now this is the United States. So this geopolitical alignment with Britain in the past, and now more with the US, has created out of Greece's geography a geopolitically a very important situation for today's international politics.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me turn now to some of the questions that are being posed by the members of our virtual audience. There's a question from Elvira Wepfer. I'm not sure what her affiliation is, but it's to do with panelists' understandings of the current geopolitical unfoldings which relate to COVID-19. Let me put it more broadly. Do effects and events like the COVID pandemic, like the refugee and migrant crisis, like climate change, which may result in extensive forest fires, does this have an effect of any sort on the conception of geopolitics? Does this, in a sense, affect how Greece is either viewed or how it views itself in relation to the international environment around it, whether it's a state-centric international environment or some other kind of globalized environment? So that's one of the questions which you may want to consider answering. A second question, or let's go with that question. George, would you like to answer that question? Because it in a sense, it is part of that, if you want, globalization debate that you were mentioning before.
Well, I think that the COVID has reinforced the feeling that we all live in the same world. So it goes in the direction of what we would call the spiritual, cultural globalization, that it is also the understanding of the world. But at the same time, you can have anxiety and fear from this opening up of borders, which is expressed through the COVID in a very precise and clear way. That the fact that we have a problem which is global, but the consequences of this problem have to do with the fact that we have movement, that we have open borders. And therefore, this debate about opening, closing becomes much more concrete, much more tangible than we put it on a theoretical basis. Then, of course, we have to take into consideration the various strategies of the actors. I mean, how the Chinese used their initial success in coping with COVID. We have other consequences that have to do with the acceleration of the digital transformation, including in that the capacity and the, in a certain way, the facilitation of observation gives a good pretext in order to follow people much, much more closely. So it is an acceleration of tendencies that I would say go to the direction of movement, of circulation, more movement. But also because of that, they can lead to a backlash that encourages closing, which can be physical closing. We have seen that since with the COVID, our movements became much more difficult, but also a kind of spiritual closure of considering that there are dangers coming from the outside, from other people, that there are people that are better or worse. It is, I think, COVID is a catalyst and acceleration, but in the sense of trends and tendencies that already existed.
Thank you very much. Constantino, would you like to add anything to this particular point?
Yes, thank you. If you asked me the same question about a year ago, I would say, as we said in a conference, my new university, University of Piraeus, that nothing has changed, but now it's different. I think the major change has to do with China. I would agree with Professor Prevelakis, namely that since Greece is destined to be open to international changes and a major change since the pandemic is the open now competition between the US and China and the EU and China, to a certain extent, Greece is being influenced by that. And we see now new chains of production, new chains of distribution being set up around the world, and Greece is a part of that. So perhaps geopolitically, this is the major change that the pandemic has brought up to now, except for the fact that the EU has to change itself. It's changing. It's opening up new ways of communication between Greece and Italy, for instance, that weren't there so explicit before. And it remains to be seen until the end of the pandemic yet what else we're going to see. The hybrid, so to say, as most military officers say, a threat coming from migration has not been that great in the past 2 years, as migration has slowed and is not that of a priority right now in Greek politics. It is a priority in Eastern Europe. There it is a priority, as we've seen in politics, in Polish and Hungarian politics in the past weeks, but not in Greece so much anymore. So I think this is the major idea that we're going to see in the near future between China and the West.
Eric?
And I'll come in with a little bit. I mean, often when I'm dealing with policymakers, You know, just to go back on how the new world is viewed, I'll circle around to Greece at the end on this, that the building block of the international system is the state, and the wrapper of the state is borders. And that's how policymakers see the units they deal with. And here they've been dealing with COVID and the pandemic and the other types of problems you mentioned, such as the environmental issues. These are things that cross borders without permission. And that makes it international relations. And there's this tension, this push me, pull you, between wanting to close the borders as the security measure and the fact that this is a problem that can't be dealt with ultimately by closed borders. Many of the reasons just mentioned, such as by George. But one of the things that happens because of Greece's orientation, as Constantina mentioned, Greece has always aligned itself with the group or the power that has the ability to intervene to do something. And one of the byproducts of the Cold War is one of the ways this pandemic has been dealt with in developing the scientific response. The Western states have collaborated with each other in exchanging scientific information and the development of the vaccines between Germany, Britain, Sweden, the United States, and shared information in the way that some of the other countries on the other side of the Cold War have been operating in separate silos. And in a sense, Greece then benefits from being aligned with a group that's been at the more developmental end of this. So the geopolitics are still there underlying the scientific solutions to what's going on.
Okay, I've got a bunch of questions which I'd like to ask, but let me turn again to our audience. And I please do encourage our audience to put whatever questions they may have through the Q&A feature at the bottom of the screen. A question from Tasos Panoutsopoulos, who's a PhD candidate at the University of Athens. He's just submitted his PhD and we wish him luck with his defense. His question is very specific and it's specifically addressed to Eric, but I'd like all our panelists to address the question. And his question is, what do you think of Greece's deepening cooperation with China and the US at the same time? If I could just put a spin on this, it seems to me that what a lot of us have been thinking and the panel has been discussing in terms of Greece's geopolitics has been directed geographically to the east and to the south. And here we have an instance, especially in terms of the Chinese incursion, where the interest is towards the north. I mean, China is interested in the port of Piraeus because of the north and not because of the Suez Canal necessarily. So, Eric, let's start with you. Does Greece's relationship with China and the US and its membership of the European Union lead to confusion, lead to dissonance, lead to sort of inevitably to policy failure, or can we expect greater things?
I'll go back to the point made by Constantina at the very beginning of Greece. Has always managed to juggle somehow all of these competing interests that turn up in Greece. And as you just pointed out, Greece is a member of the EU. This is actually where it has its strongest voice. It's also a member of NATO, which also gives it a voice in something with the Americans, as well as the other interests with the United States. And now China has turned up as the new player in a way. That's happened before in Greece, and Greece seems to be sort of navigating between these complex waters. And I think we need to remember that Russia is still there playing a somewhat interesting role, to use an understatement, in the region as well. And yes, I think that it is going to cause tension, it is going to cause stress, and that's what the task of active diplomacy is to navigate, and to go back to the maritime theme, to navigate these tortured waters.
George, would you like to have a stab at answering this particular question?
I think that a major issue for the coming months, years, is a kind of negotiation between the United States and Europe, because the United States also have their appreciation is that China is a very serious adversary. Therefore, I think what they are trying to do is, on the one hand, to create a convincing military message through the alliance with Australia and the United Kingdom. This is very narrow. They also want the community of Western countries and also of the other allies to somehow group together in this effort to contain China. I believe that the Europeans would like to have more flexibility, and we are going to get into this kind of debate. I think that this is where Greece will be in a difficult position and will have to navigate, as Eric said. It's going to be a difficult navigation because we have to keep both our loyalty to the European Union, to which we belong, but at the same time, our linkages with the United States are very important, and our interests, the United States, are very important. So I think that this balance between the two will determine much more how Greece copes with the presence of China than directly with China. But of course, it is also China is an important player. But I think that the main issue now is what will happen between the United States and Europe in respect to China.
Constantina?
Yes, thank you. As Eric said, he has shown the elephant in the room, namely Russia. We tend to forget Russia when we talk about Greek, US, and Chinese relations. But this is still there, and it's going to be part of the equation in the future. So I think Greece will never forget that China stood by her side during the economic crisis, when it wasn't very easy for private economies to mobilize their investors to come and invest in Greece when it was, very much pressured by the European Union, to say the least. But at the same time, there are many objections to the expansion of Chinese economic influence also in the port of Piraeus, since the ship owners, Greek ship owners, believe that the Chinese should remain perhaps limited in the area they already control, but not dominate the entire shipping industry in Greece. And the same goes to other infrastructure works that will connect the port of Piraeus with the European hinterland, and was on the agenda of Chinese investors before the pandemic. But if the Greeks have to choose, I think now the expanding Greek US-Greek relationship will be an obstacle to an expanding relation between Greece and China. So the major priority right now is to meet together challenges with the United States, within NATO, and also with the French in the new alliance. And the Chinese factor will have to follow what the European Union and the United States will deem more necessary for all the allies in the end.
Okay, thank you very much. Constantina, could you stand by? Because I have a question which I think you'd like to start off by answering in terms of the panel. There's a question from Richard Schwartz, who's an LSE alumnus and old acquaintance of mine as well. And he asks whether you could say a bit more about the changing relationship between Greece and Israel. What are the factors working in favor of that relationship? What the vulnerabilities are? Could I also just broaden that out a bit? Because in your comments earlier on, you talked about the relationship between Greece and Israel, but you also put it in the context of Greece's relations with the Arab states. Let's not forget there's a burgeoning relationship with Egypt, which is very much to do with geopolitics and territorially bound. There are very increasingly deep relationships being built with the United Arab Emirates, with Saudi Arabia, with Libya for strategic reasons again. So what is the relationship with Israel? How does it fit in with Greece's other foreign policy concerns, which I think are really geopolitically driven?
It's really amazing that during the economic crisis, Greece was able to develop those relationships with Egypt and Israel through Cyprus, the relationship we call now triangular relationships and relations. That wasn't the case, let's say, 40, 50 years ago. Greece and Israel were caught in a web of mutual suspicion, since Greece didn't recognize de jure, the state of Israel, for many, many decades, nor did have an open bridge policy with the so-called Arabs by that time. Now we call them Islam, the Islam world. By that time, they were the post-colonial Arabs that were trying to set up their own nation states at that time. And Israel, on the other hand, emerged as a regional power in the 1970s, and that was perceived on the side of Greece as a threat for their regional influence. Now the situation is totally different. Israel is a very close partner and hopefully ally of Greece. The energy sector is the first sector that the two countries began to cooperate together with Cyprus, but now are now around Israel and other countries that were, used to be called the Arab countries, starting with Egypt, but also with even the Palestinian Authority. They have all set up new fora in the region, starting with energy, but moving also to mutual defense, collective defense, and other areas of economic and political cooperation. This is very promising for the region. We don't have alliances yet, but we have a very good start of relations that are being built upon each other and going to produce more results in the future. So, but Greece, Israel, and Egypt, and Cyprus, of course, are the main structure of this expanding regional relation, to which, of course, Turkey is always invited, but not as a hegemon. It's being invited as a friend and as an ally. And this is where a problem starts with Ankara.
Can I just add in, I think part of this is also maybe not geopolitics, but the chessboard of politics. Just to pick up on that comment again, Greece and didn't have good relations with Israel for a long period when Turkey did. And Israel and Turkey were close allies because they had Syria in between them. And that's where they came together as an interesting relationship. And then when Turkey's foreign policy began to change, that opened up this opportunity as Israel itself was looking for other opportunities, and shifts in Athens made that possible as well. So it's the almost chessboard-like nature of the regional situation also affects this.
Thank you. George, would you like to add a comment? Because this idea, in a sense, that Greece's relationship with Israel and the countries of the Arab or Islamic world is important to the extent that it may be changing geopolitics. And you very much try to put it to us that geopolitics is territorially bound to a certain extent, but it's also something which is cultural and psychological and intellectual and ideological. And so here, through diplomacy and through politics, Greece may be trying to change its geopolitical reality.
Let's not have any illusions. I think that the beginning of this process has to do once more with internal policy, politics in Turkey, rather than, because in fact what happened is with in Turkey, we have seen during the last decades the empowerment of the despised part of the society, the what they used to call the Black Turks of the interior. And they have become a very important component of politics. Of course, they are behind AKP. Those people have a very conservative Muslim approach. And this created a situation where the Turkish state had a great difficulty in continuing its close alliance with Israel. And I think that this changed completely the balance, since Israel is a state that always feels threatened, and they understand that they have to adapt to an environment. And then the rapprochement with Greece became important. I think that this is what started a chain of events that has led, of course, in a very, very positive situation in respect to the Greek-Israeli relations. But I think that this is also a very good case of how internal politics, or geopolitics, if you like, which have to do with geography, because it has to do with the distribution of population, with economic growth, etc., how internal politics influence the behavior of powers on the more traditional geopolitics.
Okay, thank you very much. We are running close to the end of our time, and I've got a series of questions which I'd like to put to you, and I'm going to put these to you generally, and please feel free to answer whichever bits of these questions you wish to, and they come from a variety of different points of view. There is a question which has come through from our Facebook audience from South Africa, from Harry Gouvelius, who says, can we view the Greek diaspora from a geopolitical lens, and if so, has it or how can it impact on Greece? I think this is something that George may wish to comment on. I'd like to pick up personally on something that Constantina said, which I found very interesting and I think really needs a bit more explanation and perhaps discussion. And that's the idea that we've come close to the end of Turkocentrism in terms of Greece and its geopolitics, and that we're casting our net a bit further abroad. And I think there may be some debate there as to whether this is the case or not. A third question which came into my mind is the idea of geopolitics and Greece's relations with the Western Balkans. I remember at the beginning of the post-Cold War period, when there was some debate in certain circles in Greece about the Balkans being Greece's heartland, and that this is the geopolitical future of Greece in terms of determining its role in Europe as being, if you want, some kind of hegemon in the region. I think how wrong were we there? And last, from my point of view, is a question which is quite broad, and I think it relates to something that George was saying earlier on, and that is, to what extent do ideas change geopolitics? Coming back to what we were discussing before, for example, prominent American social scientists in the 1990s wrote about the clash of civilizations. Samuel Huntington produced a thesis which talked about fault lines running through various parts of Europe and elsewhere. And I mentioned Europe because in the context of Greece, this became an important discussion point. So do ideas actually change geography and change politics in this respect as well? Because the clash of civilization was about the creation of new worlds and about the creation of new worlds with real lines and lines of division running through populations and not necessarily countries. So there's four different questions there: diaspora, Turkocentrism, the Balkans, and clash of civilizations. Please feel free to address each or any of these. Eric, could I start with you on this occasion?
Do ideas change geography? I think I was trying to allude to that when I suggested that even the idea of Europe has changed shape over time, and that Greece is now clearly seen by other states as, nobody doubts, part of Europe. But in 1821, that might have been an issue of debate. It was something at least vaguely called the Levant. So ideas did change, and they changed politics as well, because it was important then to have an engagement with Greece that was different than with other parts of the world. And I think on the issue, I will leave to others to talk about Turkocentrism, other than to say that I think that is a question that's actually come up in more than one discussion I've heard, which is an interesting one. As people think about what's happening in policy, they are wondering to see if that's going to be a change, as people are also trying to read the tea leaves, by the way, of what Ankara is doing.
Thank you very much. Constantina, a couple of those questions were really directed at your comments, so perhaps you'd like to explain this idea of, you know, decentering Turkey from Greece's geopolitics and foreign policy, plus perhaps say a few things about the Balkans as well.
Okay, thank you very much. I totally agree with Eric and the fact that ideas and Huntington in this case really change the way we see geography and the way geopolitics are organized around the world. So this is a catalytic view of geopolitical realities that we're still in today. Now, regarding Turkocentrism, we had a discussion with a Cypriot foreign minister, Mr. Stavroulidis, about a couple of weeks ago, and he repeated the same thing like Foreign Minister Nikos Dendias about 4 months ago, that Turkocentrism is dead in Greek foreign policy. This doesn't mean that Turkey is not an important ally, is not an important country in the region. We are allies in NATO. We have to discuss with each other. I'm very much in favor of the dialogue with Turkey all the time. But as I said before, the problem in the past few years, not only with Greece, but also with the US itself, has been that hegemonic idea of Neo-Turkism or Neo-Ottomanism that is being projected by Turkey very often and by its current leadership. That is a problem. And of course, there's also always a Cyprus issue, which is a very difficult issue. It's not an easy issue to solve and has to do with influence in the Eastern Mediterranean. This is will always connect and divide Greece and Turkey. On the other hand, both Greece and Cyprus are seem determined not to depend on what The president of Turkey says every day on what kind of new demands come from the other side, from the other coast, and would like to cultivate other alliances that have remained halfway just because of this Turkocentrism in the past years. I remind you that the summer of 2020 was a very hot summer, except for the pandemic here in the Eastern Mediterranean, the Aegean. The Greek Navy was there, and everybody was afraid of perhaps an accident, that an accident might happen between the two countries. So this usually is an obstacle in opening up to the rest of the world and trying to see what has changed geopolitically. It's a sort of blindness that can be generated by just concentrating on the same issues all the time. And on the other hand, the fact that Turkey has been prolonging and expanding the agenda it has between with Greece, starting just to remind you from the Piraeus race in the 19 the Venturine race, the Hora ship in the 1970s, and now I have the gray zones and the exclusive economic zones as a new issue, and the Lausanne Treaty in the past year. So this creates a tension on the part of Athens and on the part of Nicosia. They would like to move away from that. Although, I repeat, Turkey remains a very important country in the region and is always welcome to join the regional initiatives, but not in a hegemonic way.
Thank you very much, Konstantina. George, over to you. There are two questions there which I think are probably more interesting for you, but especially the one about the diaspora, which is something you've written about. But please feel free to comment on any of the questions that I put before.
Yeah, sure, I'll comment on diaspora. But I would like just to give an example about this dimension, this, let's say, spiritual dimension of of geopolitics. On which, of course, we all agree that geography is not something material. It is the way we interpret, perceive, imagine, etc. In the case of our dispute between Greece and Turkey about the Aegean, about the islands. And for me, it's very clear that each side starts from a different geopolitical representation. The Turkey starts from the idea that the center of the nation is on land. We, in spite of the fact that we have abandoned much of our maritime tradition, still, I think, have in our mind that the center of our nation is in the sea, in the archipelago. And of course, if we see the historical maps since ancient times, it has always been a space around the sea. So if you start from those two different positions, the center on the ground and the center in the sea, you end up in very different conclusions according to the share of the Aegean. For us, the center is in the Aegean. It has two peripheries. The one is Greece, and the other used to be Asia Minor. We have been amputated from one side, and now we feel that we are threatened to lose even our heart. For the Turks, it's the contrary. It is two territories, Greece and Turkey. In the middle, there is a space, a maritime space, and it is normal to share it, to separate it. And it is an anomaly that Greece occupies most of that. So we may think that the Turks are wrong, the Turks are thinking that the Greeks are wrong, but in fact, this misunderstanding is based on different geographical representations. And this also has an impact also on, let's say, our diplomacy, because according to the kind of geopolitical representation that may have the French, the Germans, the Americans, etc., they may side with one side or the other. So I would say that the Germans would side more from on the territorial side and find that the Turks are right. Hopefully, the British would see things more on our side, that the center of life is on the sea. Now, about diaspora, obviously, I mean, this is a big debate that has been going on for a long time, because we understand that the diaspora and the merchant marine are real forces forces that have a global capacity. Therefore, we are thinking, but can't we combine the two forces? Well, you know, it's not by the addition of forces that you create a power, that you create an actor. The thing is whether those forces can be coordinated, and also what are the conflicts and the contradictions among the two. Let's not forget that the diaspora is made out of people that left Greece for certain reasons. Let's not forget also that those that remain in Greece perceive the diaspora people as a threat, that they may come and claim something out of Greece. And this is something that we have seen very clearly, for example, in the debate about the universities, where Greek academics of the diaspora are not welcome in of course, there are exceptions. There are colleagues that are very hospitable, etc. But in general, they are not welcome in the university. And we know that sometimes there have been some incidents. So the only way to really find the means to coordinate and combine is not to hide those contradictions, because then we don't go anywhere, but on the contrary, to discuss about them and see how we can overcome, or maybe how we can find some compromise. But it is not it's not an easy question. It's not something evident, and unless we do this effort to analyze, to understand, we will all always end up with the same disappointment that we try and doesn't work.
Thank you very much. I think we've come now to sort of natural end of time. It's interesting that even though we've been discussing geography and geopolitics, the world of Zoom and virtual reality has meant that we've been able to bring together Konstantina Votiou in Greece, George Prevelakis in Paris, and Eric Goldstein in Boston, hosted by the London School of Economics, to discuss some really important issues which bridge the gap between 1821 and 2021. I'd like to thank our speakers very much, both for accepting the invitation to come and speak on this panel, and also for sharing some very important thoughts and considerations with us on this important question of geopolitics. Let me remind you, as you can see on the screen in front of you, that we do have an upcoming event at the Hellenic Observatory on Tuesday, the 2nd of November, on public trust and citizen engagement in Greece. It starts at the same time as this event at 1600. I'd like to thank our audience, both for being there and for posing questions. And most importantly, I'd like to thank our panelists, Konstantina Votiou, George Prevelakis, and Eric Goldstein, for their time and for their efforts. Thank you very much indeed. And I hope to see you all soon again at another Hellenic Observatory event. Thanks.